So welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Professor, no less, Nick Chater from Warwick Business School. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
So, Nick, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and also about the work that you do?
Yes. So I'm a professor of behavioral science, and behavioral science is really the interface between the psychological, natural, scientific approach to understanding the mind through doing experiments and looking at the brain.
Yeah.
On one hand, on the other hand, looking at the social sciences, trying to understand economic behaviour, how businesses work, political processes. So you're looking at the sort of business and political and social world through the lens of natural science, I suppose. That's what we do. And so I've been helping to develop a group at Warwick Business School over the last 3.5 years. And we now have a large group with 10 faculty working in this area, and lots of grant money and lots of PhD students and lots of exciting things going on. So it's a very good time to be working in this field.
Fantastic. Now does that sync and work in partnership with behavioral economists as well? I mean, I ask this because I have an economics background, and I was very lucky that I was able to, when I was at university, I did almost a double major, to use an American term, with psychology and economics, but then I had to actually choose economics or psychology when I went to honours, and I chose economics. But I've always been fascinated by that side of things, so I'd be interested to understand, do you work with behavioural economists?
Absolutely, yes. So about half of our group have a stronger background in economics and moved into trying to use psychological insights to improve economic theory.
Right.
And roughly the other half are coming from the other direction of being trained in psychology, but then interested in applying psychology to economic phenomena. So behavioral science is really just slightly more general than behavioral economics, because it applies to political processes or social aspects of the social world, which aren't actually strictly economic. But we certainly behavioural economics is absolutely the core of what we do.
Excellent. Now, the thing that triggered this interview was that I recently saw a press release about how our brains are hotwired to make us all storytellers, and based on some behavioural research that you and others have been doing. So can you tell us a little bit more about that and some of the stuff that you've learned?
I think at a very sort of broad level, the brain is a pattern seeking, a pattern finding machine.
Mm-hmm.
And so thinking about, for example, just looking around the world around us, there are patterns everywhere.
Yes.
And of course, if the world were just a sort of sea of white noise, we'd be unable to deal with it. But of course, if we couldn't detect patterns effectively, then we'd essentially be in that position. So our brains are there trying to work out why the world isn't just noise, isn't just chaos. And that's a really hard problem, because although, as I sort of scan around the room with my eyes, it seems that there's all kinds of regularities. There are sofas and desks and there's sunlight coming in the window and so on. But in practice, of course, from the point of view of the brain, all I've got is a sort of noisy sea of neurons firing.
Yeah.
So trying to solve that problem is a thing that the brain is doing at the very most basic level, and all brains, not just ours, of course, all brains throughout the entire animal kingdom are doing the same job.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about human beings is that we're not just interested in understanding the inert world.
Mm-hmm.
We are especially and perhaps uniquely able to understand other people. So we don't just think of other people as just one more object. We're thinking of other people as rather like us, as guided by beliefs and aims and motivations. And so we're trying to understand people by trying to work out what those are. And it could well be, and indeed it's hardly be the case, that either we are unique in this regard, or at least we're very close to unique. Other animals don't seem to be able to think of each other in terms of attributing beliefs and desires and so on. Now, so this is a special kind of pattern. So this is because the kind of patterns that underlie human behavior are all about the sort of intentional agency. We have aims, objectives, and other people have aims and objectives. And when we're trying to understand what people are trying to do, we're thinking, well, what are they trying to achieve? What do they think? How do they think the world lies? And that is the core of stories. So really what stories are is sequences of of beliefs, objectives, actions which relate to those, and then further action. So crucially, stories aren't just an unfolding of stuff happening. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's just a sequence of one domino falls and then another one. Mm-hmm. The players in stories have an intentional life. They have a sort of aims and objectives, and we're interested in those being revealed by the action of the story. So this general desire to find patterns, which our brain is, and all brains are wired to do, in the human case, has a special additional feature, which is the attempt to impose story-like structure onto other people's behaviour.
Right.
And the other thing I wanted to stress here is that you might imagine, and intuitively we do imagine, and I'll give you an interesting experiment to think about in a second to sort of pin this down. You might think intuitively, well, of course, I'm trying to sort of tell a story about other people's behaviour so I can make sense of it. But of course, in my own case, I can just see what my motivations are, what my beliefs are, because they're mine.
Yes.
I should just sort of refer to them directly. And in fact, it turns out very interestingly that's an illusion. So in fact, we're not just storytellers about other people, we're storytellers about ourselves as well. So let me tell you about an experiment by a friend and colleague of mine called Petter Johansson. And Petter used to work in my lab, and we've done some work together. But the experiment I'll tell you about is one that he did before he joined us. It's entirely his work with his collaborator Lars Hall, and mm-hmm. Lars and Petter are both based at University of London, Sweden. So what they did is they gave people pairs of items. They could be anything, but in the most famous example, it was pairs of faces. And you had to say, which of these items, faces, would you prefer?
Yes.
Do you prefer? You say, well, I think that one. So it might be two faces. You think, oh, that's slightly more attractive, that face. Now then, you're handed one of the faces, and the experiment is in front of you. They show you the two objects. They hand you the one that you chose, and you say, and they ask you why, and you give an explanation. Uh-huh. So you tell a little story about why you chose it. On a small number of trials, on a small number of occasions, you do a magic trick, literally a magic trick. So to do this experiment, you have to learn a bit of close-up magic.
Right.
And you give people the wrong face. You actually give them the face they didn't choose.
Right.
And there are two interesting things about this. The one, which I think is neat, but kind of exciting and fun, but actually not that informative. The first thing is we just don't notice. So most of the time, with exceptions, but most of the time, as long as the faces aren't too different, you don't think, hey, well, that's the wrong one. I didn't choose that one. You just accept it. But much more interesting than that is that when you have chosen the wrong face, you then make up a story about why you chose it. And often that story cannot possibly be the right story, partly, of course, because it is the wrong face. But also it will refer to features of that face or hair or whatever it is, or clothing, which is simply the wrong person. So you'll say things like, oh, very nice earrings, or I really like that kind of curly hair. But actually, you chose someone who didn't have any earrings or you didn't have curly hair.
And is that because we just want to be right?
Well, we want to be, yes, I think that's right. And we want to make, it's trying to make patterns where we are filling in this case, our own beliefs and preferences.
Right.
So it's painful to me to think, oh, I thought I liked this, but then I chose this other thing. Well, that just doesn't seem to fit together.
Yeah.
So, of course, if you say you just chose this, I think, well, yeah, I guess I did, and I guess, well, let me explain why, and I'll tell a story which fills in a sort of narrative about why that was my my appropriate choice, because it wasn't my choice. So the thing we're often saying, of course, to each other in daily life, we're saying, oh, well, you're justifying that now, but that's just a rationalisation. You didn't really. And of course, what this kind of experiment is showing is that that's all too true. And there are so many other such experiments.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of other similar things where you get people to choose between different kinds of garments, for example, or to choose to go in one left or right, or whatever it may be. And what you do is you make some subtle change, subtle act, which might be looking more at one garment. So the experimenter might look towards one garment, they might gesture towards it, they might brush against one of the garments, or they might make one of the subject brush against one of the garments, all kinds of things, which actually should be irrelevant to the choice, but in fact tend to be quite, not completely decisively determine the choice, but make a big impact. So again, the person will deny it, and they'll say, oh, no, it was nothing to do with that. It wasn't because you kept looking at it. It was because I genuinely do prefer that fabric, or I do prefer that, that food. But in fact, you can see over many subjects that actually these non-conscious factors are having a big effect. So we'll basically make up a story to justify our behaviour, And we won't really, we don't have direct access to our own preferences and our own beliefs.
So that means it sort of implies to me we are our own worst enemies.
We can be. We certainly can be. Yes. I mean, in a way, it means from a business point of view.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that is important is that retailers often and companies generally often think that the customer has a very clear sense of what they're after.
Yes.
But in fact, they really don't. And we sort of intuitively from the inside, you kind of wander into a shop and you think, oh, goodness, I need a pair of shoes. Oh, heavens above, I just have no idea what to do. There's hundreds of them. I don't really know what my criteria are.
Yes.
And so intuitively, it feels right. But the truth is that you know, that intuition of bafflement is absolutely true. It's, you can be, by the right cues being in the environment, you can be drawn to think, it's all about fabric or leather or color, or you can start to focus on one thing or another, and you can be convinced that a particular style is in or it's out, or you know, we're very, very unstable. So okay. I think as consumers, we need to be aware of the fact that we're very unstable, and we need to be careful not to be manipulated.
Yes.
And of course, as retailers, you need to. I don't think you really need to be trying to manipulate your customers, because that's a very dangerous thing to do.
We might come back to that.
But you do need to realize that you can't assume that they know their own mind. You've got to think how together, you know, you and the customer are going to provide the clues to have a decision.
I think that's interesting, because I was speaking to another chap by the name of Mark Lancaster, and he's the CEO of a company called SDL, works in the customer experience sort of technology sort of space. Mm. And he said the interesting thing that they've learned over the last kind of few years is that he says, you know, if you really want business success, you can't focus on giving your customers what they want, because actually they don't really know what they want.
Yeah.
What you've got to better understand is what's the business kind of like problem and what's the business objective. And if you focus on that, then you're more likely to generate success. And I guess that if that's true and it's sort of aligned with what you're saying, then if you think about the individual consumer in a retail space, for example, then it's somebody might come in and say, I want some shoes. Well, that's fine. But then you've got to unpick all of the things about preferences. Do they wear black or brown or leather or canvas or whatever it might be? But actually, yes. If you step back and think about, well, what do you want the shoes for? And kind of what should be your experience in the past, and what have you liked and what have you not liked, what's worked well, where have you been complimented, what suits you, your person and personality better, then that would probably give you a better insight into satisfying that customer, I guess.
I think that's absolutely true. I think trying to understand what clues the customer is coming in with, and the list you've given is an extremely good list of the kind of factors that people are using. They're trying clues that they're trying to take from themselves about what kind of shoes work for me.
Yeah.
And then try and pick those up and help provide them, really. So in an example that many of us will have, it's the same exact point, but in a really simple context, is often you'll go into a shop and think, what I really want is what I'm wearing now, but not so tatty.
Yes.
So, but the shop often isn't really set up to deal with that. There's no kind of there's no simple way of finding the thing in the shop, which is broadly what you've got on at the moment. But if there were, and perhaps certainly you can imagine, you know, apps that could do this, you could take a picture of your current pair of shoes. I want some of these.
Yes.
I don't exist anymore, but there must be some like that. If you could take a photo of them, and you could suddenly get a string of offers of similar looking shoes, and maybe shoes that people who might like these shoes also like these other shoes. I mean, that would be just a different approach to the whole problem. And as you say, things like, I saw somebody wearing some nice shoes. I can describe them roughly. Can I then turn that into some actual pictures? Basically, you're trying to think what the criteria are that the customer is using, which will be very loose and very ill-defined.
Yes.
And trying to work with those as much as possible. There's another thing that's worth mentioning, which we've done work on with a spin-out company from Warwick, now independent, called Decision Technology, that I helped set up a decade or so ago.
Yeah.
Decision Technology does work mainly on consumer issues for to some extent for government agencies, but also most commonly for big corporates.
Yes.
And we did some work with a big supermarket, and one strand was about, which had the wonderful title in our own internal workings, at least, of Dream Tomato. How would you find your dream tomato?
Yes.
The project was, in a typical supermarket, the number of tomatoes varieties, the number of tomato choices you have is absolutely massive.
Yes.
You usually have 100 different tomatoes to choose from. And, of course, it cannot be that most of us go into the shop thinking, well, yes, I've really got a very specific need for these exact tomatoes. And thank God there are 100, because if there weren't, I'd be totally stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to look at the question of how many tomatoes would you need, how many types would you need to cater for almost everybody.
Right.
And also, how would you structure the choices so that people could find the tomato they wanted? It turned out, I can't recall the exact figures, but it turned out that the number of types of tomato was extremely small. I'm thinking of something between 8 and 10. That's the sort of number.
Okay.
And the divisions were also quite few. So roughly speaking, people think, do I want a lot of tomatoes? Well, not very many tomatoes. So that's one dimension. Do I want teeny little tomatoes or big tomatoes? And there may possibly be an issue of on the vine, but I think that may not be too much of an issue. I think really the next question is something like, do I worry about organic or organic slash sort of ethical, or do I not?
Mm-hmm.
And there may be one or two other sort of minor variations. But once you've decided on those issues, you've just got you've got it close enough to what you want. So, but of course, what's actually happening in a typical retailer is quite the opposite. So, rather than having a really stripped down set of options, it does depend on the retailer. But in many retailers, of course, you've got quite the opposite. You've just got a complete deluge. So there, it's like the problem of trying to find some shoes, but you just don't have many opinions about it. You're happy with almost anything, but there's just so many of them, you just can't. You're just bemused by the vast range.
Yes.
So trying to make the choice set small enough that people can easily make the choice is also important.
I'm just thinking about that now. I mean, there is that element, that sort of idea around the tyranny of choice, and also there's just that this. I feel like a sort of there's a paradoxical bit, I guess, in when you get to business where you feel like, particularly in terms of business strategy and growth, people say, oh, well, if we add more lines and we add, we expand the choice, then we'll grow. And that works to a point.
Yes.
But as things proliferate, then it becomes actually more damaging. Then there's been all sorts of studies to support that. And therefore, and I'm just thinking about what we talked about earlier, and that it sort of implies to me if you wanted to make the experience for your customer, whether they're in a retail environment or other environment, then almost leaving them to the self-serve side of things is can be dangerous unless you designed the experience really, really well. Or you have to think about how do I help people make those decisions, because there's that decision making process, and left to their own devices it might be that people get confused and don't make a decision, or actually make a decision and it's suboptimum, and then they decide not to come back because they haven't made the right decision.
I think that's absolutely right, and that also relates to the question that we touched on earlier of to what extent it's a good strategy to be thinking of yourself as a retailer as trying to in any sense exploit customers.
Yes.
It'll define nature of customers' preferences. And I think the point you make is exactly the right one, that if to the extent that the retailer fails to give the customer what they actually something that they actually walk out happy with, it's not so much they give them what they want in the sense that implies that they have a clear sense of what they want before they start. And of course they don't.
Yes.
And we all sit to go to the shop thinking, well, it's kind of got a few constraints here, and you end up with something, and you either think, yeah, actually, but now I see that's exactly what I want, that's great.
Yeah.
Or you go away thinking, either as you say, you don't buy anything, or you feel, well, this isn't quite right, but that's the best I can find. But of course, the for most businesses at least, the importance of repeat business and the strength of reputation and recommendation and so on is so much more important than the individual purchase. So
yeah,
the most. So I know, thinking about again retail, one of the things that we've seen a lot in with big retailers is that they're actually, interestingly, extremely nervous about any offer they give people, mm-hmm. which is superficially attractive, and people will take it up, but then will backfire. So if you have offers on fruit, for example, if certain kinds of offers can get in, end up with you with sort of 20 nectarines, all of which you've got to eat within the next 3 days,
yes.
Then there's great nervousness about that kind of offer, because superficially you can think, well, this is a great deal. These nectarines look really nice.
Yes.
And it's good. The price is cheap. Great. But of course, to the extent that the customer feels at the end of the experience, well, I just feel I've been badly served. That's very dangerous. Because going back to the sort of construction of stories and patterns, one of the things that we've discovered with decision technology is we've discovered, and it's perhaps intuitively an obvious point, that people view companies very much like they view people.
Mm-hmm.
So although the specific personality dimensions, as it were, are a little bit different, and in fact we even run a thing called corporate personality every 6 months to see to sample the views of a segment of the public on the big brands. Big brands across the country, and the dimensions are a little bit different, but they're basically the most important dimension is I like you or I don't like you,
yes.
And the second dimension is you're powerful or you're weak,
yes.
And I think the third dimension is you're zippy and innovative or you're sort of staid and dull, but those are not so different actually from personality dimensions, and there may be good reasons for that, essentially because we're interpreting everything around us, which is animate, we view as an intelligent agent, we're interpreting it essentially as a human. Now, that means that, that you've got, as a business, you've got to try as hard as you can to treat people in a way that it would be what you'd do if you were basically wanting to build a long-term friendship with them.
Sure.
Because at least, and if anything that has short-term payoff and long-term damage is very unlikely to be effective. Yeah.
Well, exactly, because if you take the parallel within actual human relationships, there's something that you might forgive if you have a good experience with somebody or a good impression of somebody, and then something slightly untoward happens, you might forgive it sort of once.
Yes.
But if it happens again, then you'll be like going, well, that's it. In the words of the Godfather, it'd be in a consumer's or customer's mind, it'd be, you are now dead to me.
Yes, yes.
And it can be that dramatic sometimes in many people's minds.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's sometimes very hard when you're inside an organization to realize just how strongly people can feel positively or negatively about particular interactions. Because I think if you're on the inside of a business, you tend to think things like, well, we're producing the vast numbers of units across the entire country. Some of them are bound to be faulty or bound to be problematic in some way. And people can't expect that we've got these thousands of calls coming in the whole time. People can't expect us to pick up everything mm-hmm. perfectly on time. And of course, that's sort of true.
Yes.
But of course, from the customer point of view, they don't have that perspective of, oh well, I'm just the one of a small fraction, or everyone else is kind of fine, or I chose a particularly bad time to call, or whatever it is. The kind of natural, I mean, unfortunately, we all, as individuals and as organisations, tend to attribute our failings to unavoidable circumstances.
Yes.
Failure of the business, whatever, and the failings of others tend to be attributed to them. And that is that's in fact in social psychology called the attribution error, which is one of the most fundamental things. So we think of our own failings as not reflecting too badly on us because of all the complexity of the things we have to do, the number of stuff and things we have to juggle. But other people's failing because we don't see all of that. We don't see all of that juggling.
Yes.
So just see the failure.
Yes.
And so that asymmetry is actually very dangerous because businesses are very complicated. And they understand the processes they're going through so much better than the customer. So they tend to feel like, oh, this customer has nothing to complain about. And that's dangerous.
Well, it just means that you end up, people are coming at it from slightly different perspectives and there's no real understanding of what's happening. Empathy, there's an empathy gap between
I think that's exactly right. Yes, and it's easy to think from a consumer point of view, it's easy to think, oh, these faceless businesses don't know what it's like for me as a consumer. But it's a two-way street, really.
Yes.
It is true that this business is trying to serve an enormous number of people. And it's similar with flooding, which is an issue in the UK as we're speaking.
Yes.
That if you are being flooded, then it cuts very little ice with you that all kinds of flood prevention measures have been underway and lots of other flooding that could have occurred, didn't occur, and so on and so on. All you see is your local situation. So in some sense, that's a failure to empathise with the bigger picture. But on the other hand, from a point of view of the government, of course, you can't take it for granted that that people who are suffering will be empathetic with you, not at all.
Well, exactly, because people get caught up in the idea, they go, well, I'm sleeping in a house which is damp and cold, and you're going to drive off and go and sleep in your bed, which is in your house, which is nice and warm, and in a place that's not flooded.
Yes, yes.
And it's going like, so, well, we just get caught up in our own situation. But I guess, I mean, bringing this back to sort of almost like some of the stuff that we explore in the blog, I mean, what do you think that firms could be doing to sort of utilize some of these insights and to try and either better deliver better service or great experiences to them? Or is it that they should just be explaining what they're doing a bit more?
Well, I think that is a big part of it, actually. So certainly when we're talking about service failures, the more open and transparent the company is, the better, almost always.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a big point, because if one has an empathy gap, it's very important to try and share as much information as possible, because that's the way to reduce that sense of different perspectives. So that's one thing. I think another element is the from a sort of point of view of trying to improve the viewpoint of your customers when things do go wrong, is to recognize that, of course, again, being open, being apologetic, recognizing the problem has occurred, if it has, that's one thing. But also, don't underestimate the power of also doing a nice thing.
Yes.
So if something goes, again, thinking about friendships, if people do come unstuck and they upset each other accidentally, or there's some mishap, then the natural tendency in a friendship will be to apologize, but possibly also to try and make it up. And it may be in quite a symbolic way, but I think that's also potentially quite powerful. But it has to be perceived as genuine, again, as in a friendship. I mean, if you get given a kind of bauble to make up something terrible, you're going to feel even more outraged.
Yes.
So it has to be, it's a dangerous game to play if you're not going to play it wholeheartedly.
Well, I think that's a really, really great point. But I actually also don't think, and this is the challenge for business, given that the the development of business and production industrial economics and how we do business, is that the challenge here is that because you're dealing on a very human level and it's not rational and it's not necessarily mechanistic, that there is no one size fits all solution for everybody.
No, that's right. I think to the extent that you are dealing in relationships, then you have to, as with any other relationship, you have to be flexible to deal with the the person on the other side. You have to respond to what they want, what their concerns are specifically to them, exactly in the context as it would be with any other human interaction. To the extent that you feel, they always say this to everybody. An apology which comes over the tannoy in a recorded announcement, although better than nothing, doesn't feel much like an apology, because it has a sense of there's just this system.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Me, it's just it just happens automatically. So yes, I think that's right. One size fits all is very unlikely to work most of the time. Yes.
So is there anything that any other things that spring to mind, given that the areas that we've sort of explored, that you think actually here's another thing that we I should point out before we sort of wrap up.
I suppose the other thing to point out, if you're thinking about businesses trying to deliver ranges of products or services to their customers, is to think very carefully, again, about the range that you're giving people to choose between in two ways. I talked earlier about the tomatoes and the number of options you want to give people. So you want to be very careful that you don't give people too many options, and that the options they do have, they can find their way. So, I mean, supermarkets obviously have huge numbers of products in them in total, but it's okay most of the time, because most of the things, I don't have dogs, so I don't worry about the dog food aisle. That's just not on my map.
Sure.
So it's okay to give people lots of options if they don't have to work very hard to find what they want. But just, and that applies not just in retail, of course, it applies to buying a mortgage or getting a pension. You just need to have a smaller number of choices as possible to find the products that are good for you.
Okay.
But the other thing is that to realize that the other options that are available will make a huge difference to what people do, and you need to manage that in a way that's in the consumer's interest. So there's a famous study of pensions in the US,
mm-hmm.
where the way the pension system works there is that you have the employer offers a range of schemes or a range of funds, some of which will be relatively safe and some of which will be relatively risky. And the proportion, and you can put sort of distribute your money between them. Now, you'd think, if you're sort of thinking about it purely as an economist, you'd think, well, roughly speaking, people have a certain amount of risk they'd like to take. So if they just have one risky fund and one safe fund, they're just going to spread their money between the two in some proportion based on how much risk they'd like to take. If they really like risk, they'll go for the risky fund. If they really like safety, they'll go for the safe fund. And they'll just distribute their money in a balance that reveals what they really want.
Right.
But the trouble is, it turns out that if a particular employer offers more risky than safe funds, then people put most of their money into the risky funds. If they offer more safe than risky funds, they put most of their money into the safe funds. So broadly speaking, we're being pulled around. We're thinking, well, there's a lot of safe stuff here. That must be safe. It's safe is obviously pretty good. I better have lots of that.
Right.
Or indeed, some of us will be thinking, well, I'll have a bit of each. All of these things, even though only two of them are risky and all of them are safe or whatever it is, I'll just diversify as much as possible. So the sort of simple strategies we're using will often mean that the options you give me will actually be the thing that really determines what I do. So so it's really important to think very carefully about that, I think. And what I would say, the final thing I think I'd say, is this is what feeling for the importance of psychology and experimentation, really, is that it's really easy and important to experiment with these things.
Mm.
So if you're interested in, for example, pension choices or choices of mortgage or whatever it may be, then you can build something like a simple website which offers different possibilities. You can get pay subjects to choose what they think will be the best product for them, not for real, and they can do it very cheaply. You can get 1,000 people to do this in no time. And this is indeed Decision Technologies business is doing this. So it's a very natural thing to do.
Yeah.
Because then you can think, so when you give people these options, they go over here. If you give them these options, they go over here instead. And you suddenly can get a sense of what people are going to do without trying in the real world. Because, of course, once you try in the real world, real people are potentially being compromised and buying the wrong thing. So I think a bit of pre-testing goes an awful long way.
Fantastic. So my penultimate question is that around just the research and where your big minds are going to go next. I mean, so what's the future?
I think the future for me, but I think possibly also for the field actually is moving from looking at individual decision making, so individual, for example, consumer purchasing, and starting to think more about interactions between people. So that could be how people how relationships work. So this is obviously very relevant to the things we've been talking about. How, what counts as what we think of as a fair, decent deal?
Yeah.
Why I feel I've been treated fairly by the other parties. And all those questions of fairness, there's work on that. And I think there's a lot of mileage there to explore. And the other thing is thinking about issues like reputation and spread of reputation. So of course, in practice, I don't just buy. I buy and I tell people about things. I remember what happened before. As you say, the terrible consumer experience made me feel not just that the business is dead to me, but also I'm going to spend my whole time telling everybody else how much I hate it.
Well, yes.
So these questions about how, essentially, how opinions get formed, how what's cool, what's not cool, how what's in, what's out, what's viewed as solid and trustworthy versus suspicious, how these things get formed in the general population, and obviously to some extent through the media, those kind of broader social phenomena, they are exciting areas to look at, and I think great commercial and also regulatory importance.
Fantastic, that sounds exciting. So, and then my final question, Nick, is this. Is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Shamelessly plug, oh, that's a tough one. Well, I'll plug two things. I'll plug three. So I'd recommend anyone to listen to The Human Zoo, which is a Radio 4 show, which will be on iPlayer, I think in perpetuity. If you type Human Zoo and Radio 4, you'll find it. That's on sort of the world of everyday life, current affairs through the lens of psychology. Mm-hmm. There's a MOOC, massive open online course, which is totally free to anyone, called The Mind is Flat, which I present, and that runs every 6 months or so, and it's a fun introduction to behavioral science. And finally, I do think decision technology as a business is a very interesting, doing some very interesting things with trying to understand consumer behavior experimentally.
Well, brilliant. Well, I'll make sure I get all that sort of linked up and things when we when I do the write up the highlights and things. But
super.
Nick, that's been fascinating and really interesting, and I think we're only just stepping into the realms of sort of the application of behavioral science and research and better understanding how we deliver better service or better products and service to our customers and deliver a better experience and how that impacts loyalty and word of mouth and retention and all those different things. So thank you for your insights there. That's been fascinating.
Well, thank you very much.